Morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's labor unions announced their strike on October the 3rd against the high cost of living.
There is a consensus that their policy has brought untold hardship. There is a consensus that they have not done enough to take care of this hardship. And they just keep saying, give us time, give us time.
Experts discuss DRC's concerns about the December 20 elections. South Sudan's president visits Russia. The people of Eswatini vote tomorrow in parliamentary elections.
Eswatini has continued to cherish a homegrown and unique model of a people-driven democratic governance. It is a monarchically democracy.
And three East African countries will co-host the next African Cup of Nations. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of the Nigeria Labour Congress says labour unions will embark on an indefinite nationwide strike starting October 3rd because, he says, the federal government has failed to address their concerns over the high cost of living following the removal of fuel subsidies. However, a labour ministry spokesperson was quoted by local media late Wednesday as saying that the government will do everything to avert the strike. The official said President Bola Tinubu will announce new measures in his speech to mark Nigeria's Independence Day on October 1st. Emmanuel Ubuaja is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He tells me that the government has failed to fulfill previous promises.
You recall on May 29, the president in his inaugural speech said subsidy was gone, and that translated into the cost of petrol, which is the stable energy supply system in Nigeria, moved from 185 naira to 600 naira, in some places 700. And clearly it was a decision taken without any plan to take care of the repercussions. So we tried to get the government to do the right thing, and we have showed patience that have suddenly seen the cost of everything almost go up by 200% with regards to transportation, with regards to food items and all. And they kept saying, give us time. For months, we've tried protest to drive home our point. We tried 2 days warning strike to drive home our point, and the workers can't take it anymore.
As you know, every strike, there are repercussions for a strike. There is the impact on the general public. Some would say you are not serving the interest of the public by choosing to go on strike.
No, the public has even been the ones putting in intense pressure on the workers because they see the working people, they see the trade unions as their voice. They see the trade unions as those who are able to help them speak to the leaders in government as to what the challenges are. And we've tried everything, and the leaders are just not listening. So the populace do understand. The populace are clearly in sympathy with us. One thing that is resonating with everybody, including them in government, there is a consensus that their policy has brought untold hardship. There is a consensus that they have not done enough to take care of this hardship. They have done nothing, actually, to take care of this hardship. And they just keep saying, give us time, give us time. By the time you know it, we'll all be dead. They need to do something.
There was a meeting between your group and the government, and there was an agreement to hold off on the strike. Now, you are accusing the government of not meeting its side of the bargain.
Yeah, the side of the bargain is the side that we agree with them from the word go. There were subheads that should be dealt with. The subhead with regards to wage awards. The subhead with regards to palliative, to the vulnerable, including vulnerable workers. The subhead with regards to the CNG alternative to provide some relief for transportation around the country. The subhead with regards to our refineries. So we had issues with them that were short-term, they were medium-term, they were long-term. None has been addressed.
Emmanuel Ubuaja is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has announced visa restrictions for individuals believed to be responsible for or complicit in undermining democracy in Liberia, including through manipulation or rigging of the electoral process and the use of violence to prevent people from exercising their rights to freedom of association and peaceful assembly. Other violations include use of measures designed to prevent political parties, voters, civil society, or the media from disseminating their views or engagement in any other activity designed to improperly influence the outcome of an election. A statement released Wednesday said certain family members of such persons may also be subject to these restrictions. Persons who undermine democracy in Liberia, including in the lead-up to, during, and following the October 10, 2023 elections, may be found ineligible for U.S. visas under this policy. The statement said the visa restriction policy will apply to specific individuals and is not directed at the Liberian people or the government of Liberia. It said the decision to impose visa restrictions reflect the commitment of the United States to support Liberians' aspirations to have free and fair elections that demonstrate the will of the people and strengthen democracy and the rule of law. The people of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, are voting tomorrow, Friday, in parliamentary elections that critics say are not democratic because candidates associated with political parties are banned from participating. Members of parliament played only an advisory role to King Mswati III. The king explained the Eswatini democratic system during his speech to the just-concluded 78th United Nations General Assembly in New York.
Mr. President, Eswatini has continued to cherish a homegrown and unique model of a people-driven democratic governance. Like many other democracies, our constitution recognizes the role of the monarchy as well as a bicameral parliament, separation of powers, fundamental human rights, and the rule of law. It takes into account our rich cultural heritage and traditional African values in that it is grounded in respect, consensus, and communities through traditional structures. It is a monarchically democracy. Our system is based on individual merit, where candidates are nominated from their communities to stand for elections in constituencies which we call dingunla, to which they are accountable. The electorate expects members of parliament to meet as colleagues rather than combatants, to look for consensus as opposed to partisanship, and to balance the interests of their constituencies with those of the nation. In terms of our democratic dispensation, elections are a constitutional imperative and are held every 5 years. We are looking forward to Emaswati expressing their desires through the ballot box. Sibaya remains one of our highest institutions where Emaswati dialogue and play their part in determining the future they want. It is an inclusive forum where citizens, irrespective of gender and social status, discuss issues of national interest.
That was King Mswati III of Eswatini. He spoke during this year's UN General Assembly in New York. A political analyst says democracy in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, is a farce, particularly when it comes to the will of the people and one person, one vote. Professor Sipo Sipi is a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He tells me that the Eswatini-style democracy gives absolute power to King Mswati III.
Well, the first thing that one must think of when you think about Eswatini is the absence of political party. That what you have, they've created a system where individuals are elected to serve in parliament. But that parliament exists as an advisory body for the king. So you're talking about an absolute monarchy.
somebody who has power. So the king decides who becomes a prime minister. He decides who becomes a minister. And he can fire as he pleases. So this is actually a farce, in a sense, if one talks about democracy, where you talk about the will of the people, where the people can decide the direction of a country. The people of Eswatini did not have that power. They did not have that right. So they simply exist to serve the king. So all this is what has led to the protest in Eswatini. And we have seen the response by the king to have been very brutal because he controls the army and he controls the police. So for all what he can say, you cannot call that democracy. Democracy does not exist in Eswatini.
As I mentioned, the king spoke at the just concluded UN General Assembly, and he said that Eswatini cherish their homegrown democracy in which the role of the monarchy is recognized.
Yeah, I think he's the last of the monarchs, of the absolute monarch. And what has made it easier for him is that because he has been abetted by the support that he gets from also African leaders who have not called and have joined call for democracy. And also, I think some of the countries that they fund or give aid to Eswatini, they have actually made this monarchy to be prolonged.
Professor Sipho Sipe is a political analyst and a former deputy vice chancellor for institutional support at the University of Zululand. He was speaking with us from Johannesburg. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 28th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo is ready to hold its next presidential polls on December 20, 2023, according to Patrick Muyaya Katambwe, the nation's Minister of Communication and Media and Government spokesperson. Organizing a fair election, armed conflict in the eastern part of the country, and tense relations with Rwanda were some of the issues discussed at a panel discussion held Wednesday at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Africa Program. VOA's Douglas Mpuga attended the discussion and has this report.
The Democratic Republic of Congo goes for the general election in December this year, but the country is grappling with significant obstacles affecting security, regional development, and climate change, according to analysts.
The mineral-rich nation also faces other challenges, such as electoral insecurity, armed conflict in the eastern provinces, tense relations with Rwanda, and economic instability. Discussing these issues and the overall politics and security in the Democratic Republic of Congo,
Patrick Muyaya Katembwe,
the DRC Minister of Communication and Media and Government spokesperson, expressed confidence that the DRC government is ready to hold the elections as planned.
I think we are ready to have elections on December 23. We as government, what we have to do is to make sure we are providing money for the electoral commissions. We are providing security. That's why we are speaking about the country like United States to see the way we can work hardly to stop what is going on in the East so those people, those millions of people can get access to vote and register.
On the issue of insecurity and the large number of displaced people in eastern DRC,
Katembwe
laid the blame on neighboring Rwanda.
I think the main reason of all displaced people is because of Rwanda's adventure with M23 and following the Rwandan genocide. The problem started there. We have this Rwandan genocide in 1994, and then all the consequences come in DRC. Mobutu was killed, Kabila's father was killed, the country was divided.
Rwanda has repeatedly denied those allegations.
Katembwe
also noted that the people in the region would like to live in peace and harmony, and that President Tshisekedi has tried to harmonize relations with the neighboring countries. He described Rwanda's hostility to DRC as mainly economic.
People speak about economy in Rwanda. Rwanda produces coltan. Do you find coltan inside the soil of Rwanda? No. one that produced gold. Where they get those gold or coltan? It comes from DRC. It comes from DRC in which way? By doing bad things, by using proxies, by killing people. So it means that for the President Kagame, for the past 25 years, he's been doing the same. And then he get money to build this country. Now the President Tshisekedi wanted to him to walk in transparent way. He refused.
This week, a five-person core team of experts from France, Mali, Spain, and Switzerland is in Kinshasa as the advance party for the Carter Center's election observer mission. Incumbent Felix Tshisekedi of the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, the country's oldest and largest party, will be seeking re-election. Douglas Mpuga for VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir traveled to Moscow on Wednesday for bilateral talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. President Kiir's office said that the two leaders will explore various opportunities for bilateral collaboration between Juba and Moscow. The discussions will also focus on efforts to lift the 2018 United Nations Security Council arms embargo imposed on South Sudan and targeted sanctions on individuals within the Kiir administration. For more on this development, my colleague Nabil Biagio spoke with Hamdi Hansa, a professor of political science at Cairo University.
With the war in Sudan, the Russians can have some of their own food in Sudan. Why? Because I think they have an agreement to have a naval base in Port Sudan. You remember when Al-Burhan had a visit to Salva Kiir and they consider South Sudan as a good platform for any possible negotiation with RSF. When it comes to Russia here, they try to achieve some of the geostrategic gains in the area. If we have in our consideration their own presence through the Wagner group in the Sahel, and also the historical presence of Wagner in Sudan itself. I think we have to take all of this in our consideration, if we are going to look at this bilateral talk between Russia and South Sudan, between Putin and Salva Kiir.
And what is in it for South Sudan and for President Kiir?
You know, always when it comes to America and the West, they have their own conditionality. So the American, if they negotiate, they're keen about implementing the agreement between the two enemies in South Sudan and to have the transition, the elections on the track. But the Chinese and the Russians, they don't care about these internal issues, and they can provide assistance to whoever in the power. This is why all these pariah states going toward the China and Russia.
And President Kiir was just here in New York. He was just in the U.S. and now he's heading to Russia. Does that not sour relationships with the U.S.?
No, there is a power shift in the world after the Ukraine war. The United States and the Western ally focusing on Ukraine, as I said. And now in Asia, China is rising. And now the BRICS has extended its membership. So you have the rising power or the swing countries. They capture the opportunity and they can maneuvering going from one side to another side. So there is a room in this changing world for political maneuvering and for the rising power or even the global South countries to maximize their benefits moving from one side to another side.
That was Hamdi Hassan, a professor of political science at Cairo University, speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio. East African countries will, for the first time, host the 2027 African Cup of Nations. Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda were announced the winners to co-host the continent's football prestigious tournament by the Confederation of African Football. Moses Javier Rimana has the story.
It's a moment of history for the three East African countries, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda, after being declared the host of the 2027 Men's African Cup of Nations. This will be the first time for the countries to anchor the prestigious tournament since it was first held in 1957. Patrice Motsepe is the president of the Confederation of African Football, the CAF.
We're very strict in terms of the requirements that we are placing on these countries, both in terms of freedom of movement of people in and out of the countries, and the support, the infrastructure, the cooperation. We are absolutely determined to maintain the highest possible standards for African football.
Kenya, Uganda and Tanzania came together and formed a so-called East African Pamoja Bid, a Kiswahili word that means together. The three East African countries beat Egypt, Senegal, Botswana and Algeria, which withdrew 2 days prior to the announcement in Cairo. Wallace Karia is the president of Tanzania's Football Federation. He thanks the three governments of their support up to the last stage of co-hosting to the tournament. He says that Tanzania is going to make sure expectations are met so the tournament will be a success. Kamoga Sula is a Ugandan football administrator and CEO of Wachiso Giants Football Club.
I'm very happy that the East African Pamoja bid has been successful. It affects the industry positively. The football industry is assumed to grow. We are very pleased that this time we are hosting such a big tournament on the African continent, and we hope we shall get the best out of it.
Brian Otwal is a sports journalist based in Kenya. He says the three countries still have to work on its infrastructure for a successful tournament.
It's always assumed that football is stronger in the West Africa and Southern Africa, but now East Africa will have something to showcase. Kenya already having a Nyayo Stadium in Kasarani that still needs some uplifts in terms of the facility in this country. The three countries will reap out of it. So it is something to celebrate now, but then a lot still needs to be done to have a good event come 2027.
This will be the third time Tanzania will be playing in the African Cup of Nations, with the last two appearances being in 2019 and 1980. The last time Uganda played in the continent's prestigious tournament was back in 2019, when the event was hosted by Egypt, while Kenya has been featured 6 times since its first appearance in 1972. Moses Aviarimana for Voice of America.
And that's it for this Thursday, September 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botti in Washington, saying, have a great day, and please be safe whatever you do.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful. because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America.